Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Delighted to have everyone here for Orange, Purple, and the drugs between them. I'll start by introducing our two esteemed panelists, and then I will kick it off for the presentation. Our first speaker will be Jeffrey Lewis. He is a chemical engineer and registered patent attorney who concentrates on patent and trademark litigation, as well as intellectual property and general litigation matters, including those involving trade secrets. Jeff regularly represents plaintiffs as well as defendants in a range of technology-related sectors with a focus on pharmaceuticals, chemicals, mechanical, medical device, biotechnology, and life sciences. And he has represented pharmaceutical innovators in numerous abbreviated new drug application, otherwise known as ANDA, patent litigations. Jeff is a past president of the American Intellectual Property Law Association, AIPLA, and the United States National Group of AIPPI, as well as a fellow of both AIPLA and the American Bar Foundation. Jeff is currently chair of AIPPI's Worldwide Amicus Brief Committee. Jeff frequently writes and speaks on intellectual property and litigation issues. He received his JD from Cardozo School of Law, cum laude, and he earned his BS in chemical engineering from the University of Connecticut. Jeff also served as an Alexander Judicial Fellow to the Honorable Marion T. Bennett of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Jeff is consistently recognized in numerous publications, and for 2022, Best Lawyers in America named Jeff its New York Patent Law Lawyer of the Year. Our second speaker will be Andrew Danford. Andrew is a partner in Wilmer Hale's Boston office who represents life sciences and technology companies in intellectual property disputes. He has significant experience, in particular with biosimilar litigation under Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act, the BPCIA, which you will hear a lot about today. He has also litigated numerous patent cases through trial and on appeal under the Hatch-Waxman Act. Recently, he has also litigated disputes involving emerging areas of biotechnology, such as mRNA vaccines. Andrew's practice encompasses all stages of litigation from pre-suit investigations through discovery, summary judgment, trial, and appeal. In addition, Andrew has experience representing clients in dozens of inter partes review proceedings before the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, PTAB. Andrew has a bachelor's degree in chemistry from MIT and attended Stanford Law School. Following law school, he clerked for the Honorable Sandra Lynch on the First Circuit here in Boston. And with that, I will turn it over to Jeff.
Thanks, Sarah, and welcome. I'm going to start off, and I'm going to just do some table setting is a lot of what I'm going to do. We're going to give some background on the Orange Book, the Purple Book, which are names of two FDA compilations, and talk a little bit about drugs between them. And just to sort of, again, part of the table setting function is to talk about, go back one, sorry. Double click, didn't work there. Just to sort of put it in mindset, here are some examples of what I refer to as small molecule and large molecule. Large molecules called biologics as well. You're talking about things like a molecule that's, 500-600 Daltons, which is a measure of weight. And then you get into a very simple biologic. And I don't mean simple in terms of the science, but simple in terms of the number of atoms in there. And your orders of magnitude bigger. You're talking 21,000 Daltons. Again, Dalton is this measure of weight. Or then you get into really more complex biologics, much larger. And you're talking, hundreds of thousands of Daltons. So that's sort of just to give a little bit of a place setting on the differences between what would be considered a small molecule, traditional chemical, an Orange Book topic, and a biologic that would be a Purple Book topic. So let me start with the Hatch-Waxman Act. Hatch-Waxman Act is for small molecules. It is called the Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act of 1984, which is why everybody calls it the Hatch-Waxman Act, because that's just a tough name. It was enacted in large part to encourage generic competition for innovative drugs. And there's a two-part balance here. One is to try to get generics to market earlier, and the other is to compensate for time taken during FDA review of a new molecule. And so with those two balances, those two teeter-totter type balance in place, it was really meant to deal with getting generics on the market and balancing those rights. And it did that by creating a safe harbor for drug innovation that's actually much broader than just the generic world, but says if you're involved in drug development, there's a safe harbor from patent infringement. It deals with abbreviated pathways to get generics on the market, and it changes some of the timing involved in the various issues of how to get FDA review, patent litigation, and other items that we will talk about. The safe harbor provision, let me just address that at first, because you think this is a 40-year-old statute, things are settled, it's to say that it is not an act of infringement for uses solely for uses reasonably related to the development and submission of information under federal law, like the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, that regulates manufacture, use, and sale of drugs or veterinary biologics. So that's where it's cabined. There are cases that say it's not limited to drugs or veterinary products. It's much broader than that. It deals with preclinical investigation. There is a split within Federal Circuit panel decisions as to how it applies to post-clinical research, to drugs that are already on the market. But as recently as in March, we see that there's still dissents over what the word solely means. And Judge Lurie, in a decision in the Edwards versus Merrill Life Science case, a case that I'm sure those in the field will be hearing about, really takes on where the boundaries are for the safe harbor. But more generally speaking, getting back to the basics of it, the FDA maintains something, used to publish it in paper copy. Now almost everybody uses it electronically, but called the Approved Drug Products and with Therapeutic Equivalent Evaluations. It has an orange cover. That's why everybody calls it the Orange Book. And it lists every approved drug, and it lists every patent where patent infringement could apply. It lists those. Well, let me take that back. It lists certain types of patents where patent infringement could apply. It lists drug substances, the active ingredient. It lists what it calls drug products, which are really formulations and compositions, and it also lists methods of use. But there are things that are not listed, and there are things that maybe should be listed or shouldn't be listed. Currently, the Federal Trade Commission is very involved in this, and you'll hear about slightly more in a few moments. But it has mechanisms for challenging listings. But what happens is when a ANDA, an abbreviated new drug application, which is an attempt or is an application where you're asking for permission to come out with a generic, or a 505B2 application, which is a little bit of coattailing, relying on data from someone else's application to support your own application. The law requires a patent certification, and primarily because there are other things, but this is sort of more intro, primarily, when you do one of these, you have to file one of four certifications. Paragraph, and they're simply called by their paragraph numbers that they appear in the statute. No patent listed. Number two, the listed patents expired. Number three, don't approve us until the patent expires, so delay our approval. Or number four, no liability because it doesn't infringe, the patent's invalid, there's inequitable conduct, any of the, you know, license. Any of those paragraph four challenges, and that paragraph four challenge, and often you'll hear litigation referred to as a P4 litigation, that paragraph four challenge is in and of itself an act of patent infringement called the technical act, but it is the act of patent infringement. So when you're dealing with small molecules, if you get a P4 certification put in, there are requirements, and that is an act of patent infringement, and that is what launches lawsuits that can be accomplished while the FDA is still reviewing the ANDA or the 505B2 application. And so that's sort of the mechanism of getting the generic on the market, is because the certification that's filed early in the application process is the act of infringement. An infringement lawsuit can be fully litigated or largely litigated while the FDA is still reviewing the ANDA or 505(b)(2) application. So let's talk about product life cycles for a moment, just to sort of understand, because there are exclusivities that happen, and all of the patent issues and the FDA exclusivity issues exist independent of each other, and they're still interrelated. So what happens is, if a new drug application is filed and it's for a new chemical entity, there is 5 years of data exclusivity. So during those 5 years, no one can get approval for the same chemical entity. That is a NCE, new chemical entity. However, an ANDA application can be filed at the fourth year. There's also non-NCE exclusivity, which is where you don't have a new chemical entity, but you have a new use. You have something that has had clinical research and has supported a change in prescribing information. That gives a three-year exclusivity, but, and here's the but, it does not have a limit on when an ANDA can be filed. So something that has the three-year exclusivity, the ANDA can be filed at any time. Something that has the five-year exclusivity, the ANDA can be filed at the end of the fourth year. There are other exclusivities that apply, things like orphan drug. If it's got an orphan drug approval, that gives data exclusivity for 7 years for the topic of the orphan drug. There are pediatric exclusivities where 6 months in various situations can be added either onto the 5 years or onto the patent life. And then there are other exclusivities that Congress has also enacted in order to encourage various types of drug development. When you have multiple patents and listed in the Orange Book, different things can happen, right? So as you can see, here are three hypothetical patents that expire at different times. One expires before the fourth anniversary is up, fourth year is up. One expires during that fifth year, and one continues patent protection well beyond the fifth year. And so you'll see different types of certifications put in, perhaps in the same application. And so where an ANDA could be filed on an NCE, you'd get paragraphs 2, 3, and 4. On a non-NCE, the ANDA will be filed much earlier. And so you might get a paragraph 4 on all of them. But those are the situations that sometimes we see. Let me go back now for a moment to the types of patents that are listed in the Orange Book. Again, this is for small molecules. It's drug substance, drug product, method of use, but you can't list things like a manufacturing patent. Unlisted patents can be subject to declaratory judgments where they can be brought into a case or attacked. If there is a listed patent that is not asserted by the patent owner, that can be something that is there a declaratory judgment. But of course, declaratory judgments are somewhat discretionary with the district court whether to hear. And so it may exercise co-pending jurisdiction or it may not. And then there are the proofs of infringement. A drug substance, a drug product, you look at the formula, you look at the formulation. That's a direct infringement question. Methods of use. How is somebody going to use this? That's more of an indirect infringement, be it inducement or maybe contributory infringement. As I mentioned, for a new chemical entity, the ANDA can't be filed until the fourth anniversary. And that's when the certification and notice happens. Usually takes a couple of weeks to process through the FDA, so you don't know about it for a couple of weeks. But the ANDA filer is required to submit, and not only the certification, but to provide notice to the patent owner and to the owner of the NDA on the reference listed drug, the drug that it's being compared to. So there are incentives to be the first ANDA filer. First ANDA gets 180 days as the only generic, which is commercially very significant. However, there are reasons why that exclusivity might be forfeited if the generic does not go to market after approval. There are incentives for the brand name, for the innovator, to file suit quickly. If they file suit within 45 days of receiving that notice that a paragraph 4 has been submitted, they get certain benefits like a 30-month stay of approval of the drug. but it also allows for a whole dance that involves confidential information from the generic filer. They have to make an offer of providing sections of the ANDA, which is otherwise confidential, and there is an opportunity to have a discussion as to whether assert patents, particularly where the methods are involved. As I mentioned, it's more nuanced in the concept of inducing infringement, where the listed patent is for a method of use. Because, of course, for instance, I'll look at inducement, but contributory infringement's a little easier, where contributory infringement is someone who provides the approved product for that use. But inducing, that's based upon what the prescribing information is, what people call the label, right? So a proposed product, no one's using it yet. But you look at the label as the hypothetical, what would happen once approved. And the Orange Book does that. The FDA has taken a very strong position that its role in this is ministerial, not substantive. And so the FDA requires people to submit Orange Book use codes that are use codes that are published in the Orange Book. And so very often a use code will mimic or very closely align with a patent claim. And that's obviously easier to prove induced infringement when they align. And the case law says that we're going to take the product labeling that the defendant seeks, that the ANDA applicant or 505B2 applicant seeks, and treat that as if it were the approved use. So with that, let me shift over to biosimilar, and then I'll hand it over to Andrew to pull this all together. Biosimilars has been written lots of ways. It's been hyphenated. It's been capitalized in the middle. You'll see as we go through this, some of our, that it really has settled on a lowercase s, although some of my foreign colleagues still use a capital S in the middle. But it comes out of how to develop a generic version of a biologic. And a lot of this comes from Obamacare. The Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act was enacted as part of Obamacare. So it's for its first few years, as the news was reporting, there were a lot of challenges to whether Obamacare was constitutional. I think those are behind us, and we no longer have to worry about that. And BPCIA is the law that's not going to be undermined by those challenges. But it applies to biologic products. And of course, biologic product is easier to say than to identify. And the statute identifies it with this list of virus, therapeutic, serotoxin, antitoxin, et cetera, that are meant to be, here's the biologics that it covers. And biologics are largely sometimes covered by patents based upon what the biologic is, but often there's a lot of process steps and manufacturing steps and how does it grow? What are the conditions? There's a whole complexity to biologics that really go to the manufacturing variability and purification variability, various efficiencies, immunogenicities. And so the development and manufacturing of the biologic often is a central part of the patent portfolio that goes to it. And so there were various mechanisms that were used prior to BPCIA to try to get generics on the market. I was involved in cases that involved biologic license applications, even ANDA cases on biologics and peptides. Paper NDAs, the 505B2, which back in the day we called paper NDAs, but along came BPCIA to change the Patent Act. It also changed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the Public Health Services Act to create a mechanism. The mechanism, interestingly, is called the Purple Book. And the Purple Book, some would say it's a play on the Orange Book because it came later. But it's meant to include information about the date of a biologic license, what the biologic is approved. It is the list of approval, but different than the Orange Book. It does not initially contain patent information. And I'm saying initially, we'll come back to this in a moment. Patent information can be added in as the process goes along of a BPCIA challenge. And so we'll talk about that. But periodically, there is legislative proposals that try to add patent information into the Purple Book, that try to adjust various FDA issues. We'll talk about the stays and talk about how the listings go. That legislation is probably not going to happen this Congress, but it comes up periodically. So there's two types of biosimilars. Generally speaking, a biosimilar is something that's physically, chemically, biologically, clinically similar. Not identical, but similar. Then there's sort of this subset called interchangeable biologics, interchangeable biosimilars. And an interchangeable biosimilar is one that quite literally can be substituted out. We're out of the original. We can give the patient the biosimilar. That only happens in the interchangeable context. And it has to have proof that there's safety, no diminishment of efficacy, and no greater risk from substituting A for B. There are some differences. Interchangeable is not considered a new entity, but a biosimilar just generally is. Substitution is allowed for an interchangeable. There are market exclusivities for an interchangeable that do not exist for, I'm going to use the phrase, and I don't mean it to sound pejorative, mere biosimilar. There are exclusivities that the biosimilar will get to. In the interest of time, I'm not going to spend a lot of effort walking through the exclusivities, but they exist. A biosimilar does get certain benefits from being the approved biosimilar. And there is exclusivity for the reference product. For the first product, just like we had 4 years, then you could file an ANDA under the Hatch-Waxman, but it can't get approved till the fifth year. For biosimilars, there's a four-year rule that no submissions, no ANDAs, if you will, no biosimilar applications can be filed until 4 years after the reference product was first listed, first licensed, and listed. And it cannot be approved until 12 years after that approval happened. But there is also the pediatric exclusivity issue that tags in an additional 6 months. There are limits on the 12 years of exclusivity. So you can't get that 12-year exclusivity for a supplement. It has to be a true biologic licensing application, and subsequent BLAs, subsequent licensing applications, have limits as well. And just to sort of try to bring this a little bit home in terms of corresponding between the Orange Book and the Purple Book, the Hatch-Waxman Act and BPCIA. Hatch-Waxman, the structure has to be basically identical, not true BPCIA. Clinical studies have some differences. And I was saying BPCIA, I mean the biosimilar, not the interchangeable. Bioequivalence, not fully required for BPCIA. It is for Hatch-Waxman. Substitution only happens for interchangeables on the biologics, but it happens automatically at the pharmacy level for small molecules under Hatch-Waxman. The timing is somewhat similar in terms of the 4 years you can file, but the exclusivity before an application can be approved either as a biosimilar or as a generic for small molecule is quite different, depending on whether it's in 3 years if it's a non-new chemical entity and 5 years of new chemical entity. And of course, the pediatric exclusivity is added to the patent or the FDA data exclusivity for Hatch-Waxman, but biologics only get it added to the BPCIA. Let's talk for a moment about what happens in a BPCIA challenge. There is a whole dance, and that's not my word. That's the word the courts use. The BPCIA litigation disclosure dance is pretty interesting. It ends up being this 200-day where the FDA accepts the abbreviated biologic license application, and then there's a disclosure requirement, listing of patents. The applicant lists patents, and they go back and forth trying to figure out what patents would actually be in a lawsuit. Elapsed time, 200 days. So you're talking, it's roughly 6 to 7 months. And sometimes we see issues like IPRs thrown in there and discussed. But that's sort of how the math happens of the first part of the dance. And I will tell you, these are not the only dance steps. We could spend an entire hour just talking about the dance steps. There are penalties if an applicant fails to provide the application and manufacturing information. But, despite what's in the statute, in the Sandoz versus Amgen case, which 2017 case out of the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, we'll see a couple of different places, has narrowed and limited the various penalties and the requirements. There are disclosure phases where later patents can be disclosed if you get a patent afterwards. But the truth of it is not everybody wants to participate in the dance. And I love it. You do a Google search and you find all these movies where a character has said, I don't dance. Whether it's Bull Durham or it's Harrison Ford in Clear and Present Danger, there are all these characters that say they don't dance. And the truth of it is, same in the patent world. People don't have to dance. And so, again, the Sandoz Amgen case, the FDA accepted the abbreviated BLA. There are requirements of notice of commercial marketing as part of it. But they refused to provide the information. And the Supreme Court said, you know what? You don't have to dance. You can sue immediately for patent infringement. And the reason they said that, and the reason that's relevant to the dance is, as I said, there are more dance steps. So in a dance step, parties, after notice of commercial, they can agree to litigate immediately, in which case the reference product's sponsor, the person, the innovator, has to sue on each listed patent, or they can disagree, and then there's a whole exchange and information and deadlines that are all statutory, and then it ends up in a lawsuit. So there are lots of dance steps here. But once suit is filed, an applicant has to provide notice and a copy of the complaint to the FDA. It gets listed in the Federal Register. It's now a purple book patent. There are mandatory injunctions that can apply based upon what happens in the outcome of a BPCIA litigation. There are penalties that can apply based upon how an applicant participates or provides detailed statements or how it progresses. There's also an opportunity, in addition to stays, there are preliminary injunction phases that are applicable because the applicant for the abbreviated biologic application has to provide notice to the reference product sponsor that they're going to launch at least 180 days beforehand. And this allows litigation steps as well. It's part of another dance routine that's under BPCIA. And all of it, BPCIA, by the way, in addition to the Orange Book, requires that parties must reasonably cooperate in expediting discovery. Again, the Sandoz versus Amgen case, they've done a lot to contributing to our understanding of the law, providing notice. Sandoz didn't. Lo and behold, it resulted in more lawsuits. There are penalties against a reference product sponsor. Also, it's not just one-way penalties. Reference product sponsor can also get briefed and get in trouble if it does not expedite discovery and provide certain notices. These slides will be available. So I know we're moving quickly, but I would commend the various statutes to you to double check. The basic strategic considerations, an originator, an innovator, reference product sponsor will file a BLA. Someone seeking to market a biosimilar will file an abbreviated BLA, an ABLA. There is no bar to approval for a BLA, but an ABLA is 12 years. That could mean that there are competing biologic license applications where one is not relying on data from another, and there may be subtleties in the structure of the biologic. And so that's always an interesting problem. Non-patent exclusivity, there's none for an abbreviated biologic application. There's a short term for interchangeables, but of course there's 12 years if you have a BLA. Patent exclusivities, yes for the BLA, no for the biosimilar. And patent litigation allows for early resolution. There's a BPCIA framework for the biosimilar, making sure that litigation is resolved in advance. Bringing it back to the Orange Book versus the Purple Book, you have patent listings, BPCIA initially none. Of course, we saw the asterisk on that none, that patents get added and published in the Federal Register as the dance moves forward. Patent listings, again, are similar. Orange Book, they get listed if it's product or its use. or even in the ingredients. But the Purple Book, the BPCIA, the patents it owns and has are not necessarily listed until after the dance starts. Process patents do not get listed in the Orange Book. They can be listed and asserted as part of a BPCIA litigation. The factual legal basis for the various challenges. In the Orange Book case, the applicant has to provide a statement, but there is no requirement that the innovator respond, whereas BPCIA, the applicants, and the reference product sponsor engage in, again, the dance. They exchange statements. They go back and forth. Exclusivities, 180 days for an Orange Book paragraph 4 filer. In the case of BPCIA, the first interchangeable biosimilar on the market, but there are sort of variations of how this is statutorily captured. Finally, before I hand over the microphone, FDA approval process linked to litigation. Yeah, in the Hatch-Waxman Act, there is the 30-month stay I referenced if suit is brought within 45 days. There's not necessarily an FDA approval stay in BPCIA. It's much more nuanced, and it's not the sort of 30 months, that same sort of hard rubric that you see under the Orange Book. There is also agreements in respect to patents, paragraph 3 certification. Hatch-Waxman, you can say, don't approve us until the patent expires. It's not quite the same under BPCIA. It's challenge or not, although it may be part of the negotiations between the parties. And then the reference product sponsor wins in patent litigation, and that approval is stayed until patent expiry for a Hatch-Waxman case for small molecule. For a biologic, there is not the stay till FDA approval. And so thank you. With that, I will literally pat the mouse and the microphone.
Thanks, Jeff. Again, I'm Andrew Danford, and I'm going to address in the second half of this presentation some of the issues that can come out of Orange Book listing and some of the current problems that people are facing as a result of Orange Book listing. So what Jeff just gave us was a very detailed overview of the process, both for small molecules and for biologics. What I'm going to focus mostly on is a very particular issue that we've seen arise in the context of small molecules and Orange Book listings. So what is that issue? Okay. The issue is improper Orange Book listings. As Jeff mentioned, there are statutory requirements about which patents you can have listed in the Orange Book, and not all types of patents can be listed. So, for example, Jeff mentioned that manufacturing patents shouldn't be listed. If you have something that covers just the device and not the active ingredient, that's not something that should be listed either. What you have to have is either something that covers the active ingredient, a formulation or composition, or a method of use, and it can't be just any method of use. It has to be a method of use for which approval has been sought, or is sought, or has been granted in the application. So if you have like off-label uses, again, that's not something that should be Orange Book listed. It's something that's been litigated and is now clearer, I think, under the way that the statute reads as it was amended in 2021. Before 2021, the statute was not as clear about what can and can't be listed. And so there were some more disputes that arose in that context. So there basically are two ways then that you can have an improper Orange Book listing challenge arise. Number one is if you have a patent that's listed that's a type that should not be included. So it's not one of the ones that covers the active ingredient, formulation, composition, or method of use. A second potential way that you could challenge an Orange Book listing is that the statute requires that anything you have listed in the Orange Book be a patent for which a reasonable claim of infringement could be asserted. And this is a challenge that hasn't been litigated, but is potentially open to people who say, well, that patent just doesn't cover the product. You couldn't have a claim of infringement against a generic, or that patent is just invalid and shouldn't be included because it is not a valid patent. It is so facially weak that it should not be listed. And that is a type of challenge that we haven't seen, but I think that you could have creative litigants raise that, or potentially even the FTC raise that as through its enforcement arm. So on the issue of the FTC, the reason why I wanted to discuss this topic today is it actually is a very active and hot topic, and the FTC has increasingly inserted itself into this area of Orange Book listings. This is just a timeline showing some very recent activity. So last September, the FTC issued a policy statement saying, we view Orange Book listings as an important improper Orange Book listings as a real problem. It is an unfair practice. It delays generic competition, increases prices to consumers as a result because you're not getting the generics, which typically results in a substantial drop in drug prices. And there are some additional harms that the FTC says could potentially flow from this, like it's discouraging people from developing generic drugs in the first place. I think a lot of that is still speculative and hasn't really been proven up in any particular case, but that's at least what the FTC's position is. The next event here is, after putting out that policy statement, the FTC about 6 weeks later followed up with letters to like 10 different companies who had Orange Book listings, saying, we're going to challenge your Orange Book listings as improper. Again, a lot of these things are drugs where there's a device included with it. So like an asthma drug or something with an inhaler. There's the potential that you have things that don't really cover the active ingredient that are being listed and that shouldn't be listed under the current statute. So the FTC sent out those letters and people actually did respond. Like as Jeff mentioned, the FDA's role in all of this is ministerial. It just gets the information from the applicant and lists it. And its role is still ministerial in the context of these challenges. There's a regulation that allows those people to challenge Orange Book listings. He submits that to the FDA. The FDA doesn't evaluate that on the merits. All it does is forward that to the company that listed the drug and say, are you sure that you wanted this listed? And it requires you to actually certify under penalties of perjury when you come back and say, yep, that's really what we wanted to have listed. But all you have to say is, yes, that's properly listed, and the FDA is not going to take it down. So some people actually did take down their Orange Book listings. I think building off of some of that momentum, the FTC just 10 days ago came back and said, well, now there are more of these patents that we think are problematic, and it sent letters out to a bunch of other folks. And again, this time, what I actually think is remarkable is both the number of patents that are being challenged is like 300 patents this time. And they're going after really big, prominent drugs. Ozempic was one that received a letter this time. So that they're clearly trying to make this a big issue, going after what they view are the important drugs. And it remains to be seen, I think, what follows out of that. That's again is just breaking news from the past 10 days. So why does the FTC think that this is a problem? Well, they've made their position known first in the white paper, and then they've actually taken a more active role in litigation. So where there are private litigations asserting antitrust violations, the FTC has recently submitted amicus briefs explaining why, without taking a position on the merits of the underlying dispute, explaining why this is an important problem in its view. And this all stems back to the 30-month stay that Jeff mentioned. So in the Orange Book space, in the Hatch-Waxman space, if you have a patent that's listed in the Orange Book, you get a paragraph 4 certification, and the branded drug sues the generic for infringement within the 45 days. then you automatically get a 30-month stay of approval of the generic application at the FDA. So that's an automatic 2.5 years where nothing can happen, where that drug will not get approved and it won't come to market. And that is regardless of the merits of the underlying lawsuit. And so the FTC views that as a opportunity for the branded manufacturers to abuse and to sort of improperly extend their monopoly by listing things that shouldn't be listed or listing, you know, patents that probably aren't all that strong. And as a result, using the statutory process, using that 30-month stay that they are entitled to under the Hatch-Waxman Act to postpone their competition. And again, you know, this all comes back to the what's sometimes referred to as the patent cliff. When you have a branded drug that comes off patent in the United States, for small molecules, there are automatic substitution laws that require that unless otherwise indicated in the prescription, you get the prescriptions filled with the generic when it's available. And so the uptake on these drugs is really, really fast. And that results in enormous price pressure on the drug. And as you can see from this illustration that the FTC has provided, typically just the prices fall by an enormous percentage very quickly. And so the FTC's view as well, the branded manufacturers has all the incentive in the world to extend that out longer, you know, by doing so every day. You know, it really does come down to even just days can be very valuable because these are billions of dollars in sales every day. And so they are claiming there is a lot of consumer harm that results just by virtue of having these patents listed and getting the 30-month stay that delays the generic entry. Now, the FTC isn't actually the only entity that has gotten involved in this area. We've seen recently that private litigants can bring antitrust claims, and they piggyback off of the same theory that the FTC has announced. So we have even pending here locally in the District of Massachusetts an antitrust class action that following on those letters that the FTC sent last fall alleges improper patent listing, alleges that there's an antitrust violation, and is seeking to pursue that as a private cause of action under the Sherman Act. So just before we dig into the case law a little bit more, just a quick tutorial on antitrust law and why we're even talking about that in this space. Why is this potentially an antitrust problem? The patent laws are, of course, closely intertwined with antitrust issues. Patents, in a sense, are a government-sanctioned monopoly. You get an exclusive right to your invention for a limited period of time. And that is actually encouraged, and it's supposed to encourage innovation. But in the generic drug space, the antitrust theory as well, these drug manufacturers have monopoly power within the space that they're within the market for their drugs. And you can't then engage in exclusionary conduct. It has to be sort of improper conduct that goes beyond competition on the merits. If you really did have a better drug than everybody else, and that's why the market is choosing you, that's not an antitrust problem. But if you're doing something to suppress competition that goes beyond that competition on the merits, then that's potentially an issue. And because the listing of these patents is an affirmative act that has the potential to exclude with that additional 30-month stay that you get from listing the patents and having a Hatch-Waxman litigation result, that's the theory of antitrust violation. In addition to just a straight Section 2 of the Sherman Act claim, The FTC also has authority to challenge unfair business practices. And the FTC has taken the position that improper patent listing constitutes an unfair business practice, again, because it's going beyond competition on the merits and trying to exclude others from the market for reasons that are improper by listing something in the Orange Book that they don't have a legal right to list. But in the antitrust context, as I mentioned, because we're in this area where patents are implicated, it's not totally clear that there is a basis to pursue an antitrust claim because, again, with the patent owner does have a right to exclude. And there's a doctrine that has arisen in the context of patent litigation and more generally antitrust litigation called Norr-Pennington immunity, which basically says if you are bringing a valid action for patent infringement, that is a protected petitioning of the government under the First Amendment, cannot constitute an antitrust violation. Just enforcing your patents in a litigation isn't a problem. There are exceptions to that. You can't push it to the limit by pursuing objectively baseless litigation that's subjectively motivated to use the litigation as a competitive weapon. So that's the sham litigation exception to Norr-Pennington. Another exception is the Walker process fraud. And that's the concept that if you committed inequitable conduct, if you obtained the patent by fraud in the first place and you knew that you did that, then you can't turn around and litigate it. And it's not going to be, you're not going to be immune from antitrust violation if you first commit fraud on the patent office to get the patent and then try to use the monopoly that you've been granted to exclude others from the marketplace. So there are exceptions, but we are in an area here where we're talking about antitrust issues and patents where there is going to be some ability to exclude others from the market. It's not always black and white, and the case law will bear that out here for us if we look at that. So I want to just quickly walk through the evolution of the case law. This goes back 20 years. There was an early litigation involving BMS and an anti-anxiety drug. BMS had a patent that was already listed in the Orange Book. It was about to expire, and right before it expired, BMS listed a new patent that it had just obtained in the Orange Book, which it was asserted in litigation did not properly cover the drug. And in fact, there was prosecution history that said, while getting the patent, that it didn't cover this drug. BMS listed it anyway. And this litigation ensued. And sort of a threshold question is, well, BMS said, well, this can't be an antitrust violation. All we're doing is asserting our patents here. Norr-Pennington immunity applies. And the court held, no, Norr-Pennington immunity does not apply because, remember, the FDA's role in all this is purely ministerial. And because it's ministerial, it's not this petitioning the government that you typically would use as the basis to say that that is permitted First Amendment activity. You're just doing what the statute does, and the FDA just lists it if you provide them the information. And then based on the facts of this case, the court said that even if Norr-Pennington were to apply, there are particular reasons why the sham litigation and Walker process fraud exceptions would apply in this case. So there is a potential, this survived a motion to dismiss. There is a colorable antitrust violation here for improper Orange Book listings. The next year, the District of New Jersey reached a similar conclusion that Norr-Pennington doesn't apply, but it actually gave a defense. And in the context of this case, it said that the branded manufacturer had a reasonable basis for including the listing in the Orange Book. It was an off-label use of the drug. And based on the way the statute was written at the time, it said, well, you could reasonably interpret it that way. And so no antitrust violation here. this is the first case that sort of presents a potential defense to antitrust liability based on the defendant's state of mind. That issue has been litigated further and has come to a head recently. There is antitrust litigation at SDNY involving Actos. This is, again, off-label uses that were patents that covered off-label uses that were listed in the Orange Book. And the branded drug in that kit manufacturer in that case said, well, they haven't stated a claim because they didn't allege bad faith when we listed it. And the court went through and reviewed and said, well, good faith interpretation could be a defense, but it is not required that the plaintiff allege in the complaint that you engage in bad faith. It's not an element of the claim. You can state a monopolization claim based on the intent to do the act. It doesn't matter whether there was bad faith. Again, this is shifting the good faith more to an affirmative defense that is on the defendant to plead and prove, and not something that the plaintiff has to affirmatively assert. And that came out very clearly in a First Circuit case from 2020 involving Lantus, the injectable insulin. The district court had dismissed the litigation, holding that the listing was reasonable, but the First Circuit said, well, that's not a defense. The defense is an affirmative one that the patentee must prove two things, both that it's reasonable and that the company acted in good faith. So there's an objective prong of reasonableness and a subjective prong that you acted in good faith. If you meet both of those, then there's a defense, but it is on the patentee as the defendant to prove this as a defense. And then this issue came up again on appeal in the Second Circuit the year after. This is the appeal from the Actos case. Although the issue was not presented as clearly and stated as clearly as it was in the First Circuit decision, the Second Circuit again rejected the requirements of unreasonableness and presented reasons why it should be the patentee's burden to prove its good faith and prove objective reasonableness and not the plaintiff's burden to show that as part of its affirmative case. So where does that leave us? There's not going to be Norr Pennington immunity. I think the law has coalesced around that. So Orange Book listings are a potential antitrust violation. Reasonableness is a defense, but the burden is going to be on the patentee to show both objective reasonableness and subjective good faith. So you got to show those two things if you want to prove up that defense. Of course, this is part of a antitrust claim. And so just showing that there was an improper Orange Book listing doesn't actually make out the antitrust claim. You've got to show an antitrust injury that's caused by this anti-competitive conduct. And so as these cases get litigated and as we see this percolate through the courts, what I think is going to be an important issue here is causation, because if you can break the chain of causation as the defendant, then there's a potential defense that is sort of aside from the fact of whether the patent was properly listed or not. And as Jeff mentioned, there's a really complicated process to generic drug approval. There could be multiple patents that are listed in the Orange Book. The generic drug could get its application rejected for reasons that have nothing to do with the Orange Book listings. Like, it could just get a 483 letter from the FDA about a problem at their facility, and the application could get rejected on that basis. So I think one thing as a defendant in these litigations, it's going to be important to think through the chain of causation thoroughly and pick at and point to issues that you could potentially use to break the chain of causation. Because I don't think that it's necessarily going to flow just from the fact there's an improper patent listing, that there's an antitrust violation. And then the last point that I wanted to raise is just sort of a practical practice tip. As the law has tended toward making this the defendant's burden, if you want to raise this good faith defense, and puts its subjective good faith at issue, if you choose as the defendant to raise this defense, there's a potential risk of blowback that if you're relying on the advice of counsel, there could be a broader subject matter relating to that advice that was received. That came up in the Actos case on remand from the Second Circuit. And it also arose in the Lantis case following remand from the First Circuit. So that is an active issue and something that defendants need to think through and be prepared for as they decide how to present these defenses. So with that, I'll turn it back to Sarah.
Actually, Andrew, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Or I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but somewhere in the middle. It seems to me as though the FDA has kind of made its bed, made the bed for everybody else to sleep in here, and that's the FTC's action, because it's more than a decade that people have petitioned the FDA for rulings on what are the nuances of what can get listed for device patents or for patents that are not on the substance, compound, or method of use, but are intimately related to whatever the approved product is. And the FDA has put out Federal Register notices saying we're not answering this question. They've, you know, denied answering petitions saying read the Federal Register notice, you know, sort of one of these.
Yeah.
And so I keep thinking the FDA has set up pharma companies to be in this gray zone and said, you know, we're just ministerial. It's not our problem if you get in trouble here because we're just setting this up for confusion. Does that comport with something you're feeling here?
That is absolutely the case. People send letters saying, is this appropriate for us to list? And the FDA refuses to answer that. And it used to be more of a problem. The statute before 2021 was less clear about what you could have listed versus not. And the statute's a lot clearer than it was now with some amendments in 2021. But in any case, the FDA has made very clear that it is not going to get in the middle of all this. If you want to raise an issue about a patent listing, literally all it does is notify the branded manufacturer. Somebody has said this is not appropriately listed. What's your position? And all you have to do is respond back and say, I certify that this is properly listed. And the FDA is going to leave it like that. And so if these issues get resolved, it is only going to be through litigation brought by private plaintiffs or the FTC. That's what we've been seeing play out in these cases.
So you're sort of running, I mean, to me, you know, when I talk to clients, they're always running the risk of, do I list and, do I list and get the Hatch-Waxman protections, or do I not get the Hatch-Waxman protections but avoid any antitrust concern?
Yeah. I think that is a risk. I mean, the patent's still out there, and if it's being infringed by somebody, you still have a route to assert it. You just don't get the benefits of Hatch-Waxman with like 30-month stay. But it is a tough place for people, and it has been, I think, for many years.
With our 1 minute left, I have one more question for Andrew. So your presentation talked a lot about Hatch-Waxman and the FTC scrutiny around the Orange Book. Are we seeing these issues arise at all in the context of the Purple Book? And if not, why do you think that is?
So, no, this is not an issue that has arisen in the context of the Purple Book. And I think part of this ties back to what Jeff said about what the Purple Book's role is. This is not something like where the branded manufacturer submits a list of patents that cover its drug. There just isn't the same sort of patent list role that in the Purple Book context. There also isn't the 30-month stay, and it has nothing to do with whether the patents are listed or not. The only thing you have to do is provide the notice of commercial marketing, which can be provided even before approval. So the whole patent cliff issue and the listing is not an impediment to launch. And then again, as Jeff mentioned, you don't even have to do the patent dance. So like you can sort of ignore all of this stuff. So I think that causation chain is going to be broken here too, because there's nothing that requires people to actually engage in this process on the biologic side.
But I think if some of the legislative proposals go through, it may actually create some of these problems, Sarah, because I think some of the mandated issues that they float in some of these legislation, some of the bits of legislation, would Andrew, you know, tick off some of the boxes you just listed?
Yeah. And it's not to say you can't have antitrust problems with biologic stuff. Like there was the Humira patent thicket thing that was litigated in the Seventh Circuit. And I think you could potentially have a claim that someone improperly included something on a 3A list during the patent dance and that that was a problem. But no one has actually raised that. And that is not a claim I've seen.
Okay. Well, thank you both. And thank you to everyone on behalf of the BBA. And a recording of this presentation will be available in a couple of days. So thanks very much. And you can always follow up with the panelists with additional questions.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.